if you ever see someone who says something like, you know, I don't get why they haven't put multiplayer in this. I've done it in a prototype, like in a weekend. You just know that that person is very, very early on in that Dunning-Kruger effect. And that's just about all you need to know.
Here's what I love about that phrasing, though. When they're like, I don't understand why this isn't in the game. The proper response is like, yeah, you don't.
Yeah,
right. Right? Like,
correct.
Yeah, no, you're that's true. You're right that you don't understand that.
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 285 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I have a radioactive cat.
I'm Sam, and I'm the artist.
This is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is Friday, the 13th November. 20 Blundy. And before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity on this show, what we call positive profanity, where we swear, but positively. So just be ready for that. Also,
which Friday the 13th is the scariest one? Would it be October, Friday the 13th?
Definitely. Yeah.
It's got to be that one, right?
Yeah.
No, it's this one because this one is Halloween is over and you just don't suspect anything.
Oh, yeah. So you know it's coming for you.
You're like, oh, thank God, the spooky season's done. I'm relieved now. I can carry on with my life. No, you can't.
And that's how they get you.
Because that's when the ghosts get you, you know. Also, we'd like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. If you'd like to support the podcast, go there and then we'll grab your money. All right, you guys. A couple things. I want to talk about the news, namely how I hate it.
Yes, I think 2020.
This is the only part of the news I want to hear about.
Yeah, 2020 has certainly been the year of needing to not listen to the news. Yeah.
So, I think there's a general sense that people have that it's important to be informed about what's happening in the world, right? Like you don't want to have your head in the sand, and you want to kind of have a general sense of the things that matter, right?
Right.
But how do you get it? How do you get that information? And where do you get it? And how do you know that it's, you know, reliable and unbiased and real, right? Mm-hmm. So for the longest time, I had been getting a lot of my news sort of unknowingly from sources like Reddit, where basically it's an upvote process, you know? Where like people post links and other people just vote that stuff to the top. The problem is, of course, you end up in this bias spiral where the people who largely agree with what's being voted up will stick around on the site, and the people who don't agree with that stuff will eventually stop coming to the site, right? Mm-hmm. And you end up with a community that people often refer to as the hive mind of Reddit, which is like everybody on there is basically a carbon copy of every other person on there eventually. And on top of that, the format of the news that you read will affect your perception of the news. So on a website like Reddit, what you'll typically do is you'll see a headline and then you just go to the comments.
That's true. Right? Yeah. Because the comments are endlessly entertaining. Oftentimes someone posts like a synopsis of the article anyways. So you're going to go read it.
Well, this is also true on Twitter, right? Because on Twitter, since you're character limited, they'll post a link. They'll post a headline. They'll post a link to an article. And then it's – replies and some comments again to that.
Yeah, some hot take, right? And whether it's Twitter or Reddit or Facebook or whatever, you have to understand that what you're getting isn't news. You are getting what people think about the news.
Well, it's not even that. It's what people think about their brief exposure to
a headline.
summarizing summarizing poorly the actual news item.
Yeah. And again, in all of those cases, you will be getting what people who you very likely already agree with think about some subset of a piece of news, right? Mm-hmm. So you're getting a lot of times things that are outrageous or rage-inducing, whatever, because those things are easy for people to talk about and give hot takes on.
They also get votes on, you know, any popularity site. Yeah,
they get shares, they get votes. And so for the past couple of weeks, I was like, you know, I'm done with all of it. I haven't been on Facebook and Twitter in years, but I was still on Reddit. And I was like, you know, I'm gonna change my information diet. So I switched to Feedly, which is just an RSS reader, right? And so I went out there and I went to some like games industry sites and subscribed to those, as well as some like web comics that I like, you know, Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And it's great because then it's just like in the, like, you know, over lunch break, during breakfast, whatever, I can check, you know, the news and actually just read articles. And I'm not seeing anything about what people think about the news. I'm just getting the news,
right? Which, of course, is hyperbolic because the news is what people think, right?
The news is what people think, yeah, but it's more unbiased. It's more direct to the source of like, hey, here's something that happened, right? Here, I'm gonna talk about a thing that happened.
Yeah, you're not starting with a random. Well, yeah, it's yeah, because if you're using Reddit and Twitter, what you're actually starting with is someone's opinion about someone's opinion. Like that's what you're starting with. So you're starting one level. Because the news is already at least one level deep, right? Because news is like –
because somebody's reporting on it.
Somebody's reporting
it. And deciding what gets reported on.
So that's already – you're already one level of opinion deep. But if you're starting two levels of opinion deep, then, you know, why? But – so I mean I think you're right about all this. But I actually think the worst part of the problem, the worst part of things like Twitter and Reddit and so on is not even that they put you in an echo chamber and that they bring the most outrageous stuff to the top and all of that kind of thing. Those are problems, but I think the worst problem is that it's happening in real time, right? Because the news like it has a few. There's a few ways to think about it. One is like literally what is happening right now, right? Is one way to think about it. But the problem with that is that nobody knows what's happening right now, right? Because what's happening right now is like you're seeing symptoms of things, right? You're seeing effects of things, right? And then what we discover later is we look backwards and we try to understand why were things like that?
Yeah.
Like, why did that happen yesterday? What did it mean? What are the consequences of this, right?
Yeah.
Was it important? Doesn't matter at all. And you can't know that until you or somebody has taken the time to digest that, talk to people involved or, you know, look into institutions, whatever, put it into context in like an understanding way because they know the context, right? And then distill that down anyway. So, but which again, this is none of this is objective, right? This is like the world is not an objective place.
Yeah.
It's all some people are digesting information and trying to find a way to present it. But if you are participating in real time as news is happening, right? Then all you're doing is you're catching little glimpses. Like you're catching the each individual piece of data that collectively come together to make the news, to make our understanding of the world. And if you're doing that, then you can't possibly have sufficient context to know how to think about that. It's not possible. You can't because you don't.
Well, and also that's not even your goal at that point.
No,
you know, like you're not a journalist. You're not saying, you know, I'm going to spend the rest of the day really getting to the bottom of this thing. I'm going to go talk to some sources. I'm going to get all of these different pieces of information. No, you're not doing that.
No, nope.
You're just getting slammed by the most outrageous tweets. Like that's all that's happening. Yep. So you're getting a fragment of a picture that is the most emotionally charged fragment.
Yeah, but this is also how 24-hour news works too, right? So this isn't just a problem with like social media. This is a problem with any system that is trying to give you up to the moment. It's the same thing with like watching the election, right? Anyone who was watching the election in real time will know. You should know now, hopefully in retrospect, that was a pointless thing to do because –
because nothing happened.
Nothing meant anything.
For days.
Nothing meant anything for days because there wasn't a way. There wasn't a way to take the information that was available and know what that meant, right? There wasn't. It's not possible. It's not possible to predict the future based on information that's insufficient to predict the future.
So what you're doing then is you're just sort of reporting and reacting to incoming data, not to actual news. So this is, I think it's most probably exemplified by the joke that came out of the U.S. election as far as people watching the maps and the updates for those, you know, 3 or 4 days. Because there was this guy, I think it was on CNN maybe, with whichever one has Wolf Blitzer on it. But there's a guy who runs the map who apparently is like, you know, doing all this crazy map stuff with that big touch screen. And every like 5 minutes, Wolf Blitzer would be like, oh, breaking. We got something that's new canon we got to look at. And the guy would be like, okay, pull it up. And then it would be too close to call every time. Yep.
So breaking news, too close to call still. Yes. Same as the past 72
years. So, and it's breaking news for 5 days as we didn't know it was going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Every 5 minutes for 5 days.
Importantly, it's not breaking news. That's just another data point. There's no news. Well,
okay. The term breaking news, though, used to be what it meant was we have another program happening, and now we have to interrupt that program because something so important has happened that we have to break in, right? You can't have breaking news on the news. That you're already watching the news. You're not interrupting anything, right? It's crazy.
No, you may be interrupting reporting one thing to report another thing. So it's also a way to like.
But you're interrupting yourself. You're just like, hold on.
Breaking news is now the modern version of a segue. It's a cheap segue, right? Which
is the fastest segue possible. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to come up with a reason why I'm suddenly talking about this other thing. So it's breaking just breaking news.
breaking news. Nothing has changed.
Yeah, but I think it's important to say that all of this is true, but it doesn't actually create a obvious path forward because the healthier move is to either do the work yourself of like trying to really figure out what's going on, try to collect all the data, like do all the work, right? But most of us don't have time for that or the training and the ability to do it, right? So your next best move is to – so your first best move is to get trained and then like do that yourself, right? But obviously not available to almost anybody. Next best one is to find people who can do that for you, right? And then in a non-real-time way, in an async manner, check the daily news, right? Like here's the summary of what happened like yesterday or conclusions about what happened a week ago, not with, you know, and so on and so forth, right? The problem there, of course, is that again, none of this is objective. And so if you're not careful with where you're getting that information from, now that it's been like really distilled, then you don't know what's being left out. You know, you don't know what's being reported to you and what isn't. And so I think the sense that people seem to have today of the value of things like Twitter and so on, where it's just, you're getting the fire hose of like what's happening in the moment, independent of context and whatever, is that you're guaranteed to not miss anything. That's of course not true because of algorithmic approaches to curation.
Of course.
Right? But it feels like that's true, that like, no one's hiding anything from you, right? That itself is wrong, but also has enormous consequences that are not good. And so the thing to always remember here is there's no winning. There's no way to be like, I actually am informed and I'm not missing anything. And the things about, and I understand what I've been informed about and that those are correct. That's not a state we get to have. Mm-hmm. So that's not a state we get to have anyway. Then you need to find out like, how do I have a healthy relationship to a best guess understanding of what's happening in the world that impacts me and the people I care about? Right.
Yep. Yeah. So where I've kind of landed on that is I'm on Feedly. I've subscribed to things that are relevant to my life, you know, and I've also largely subscribed to things that have a reduced tendency to be emotionally charged or biased. Right. So like if I'm subscribed to like, a science or space publication, and they're just like, oh, there's a mission coming up and here are the objectives of the mission that like NASA's going to do. That's all that they say. And this is just like coming straight from NASA. And I'm just like, that's awesome. I'm very excited about this.
I do want to be careful though, with this idea of like of avoiding bias and bias being bad, because you can use it in a very negative way where you can say like this person is biased and so they are intentionally misreporting, right? Or construing this in a very particular – with a very particular slant that is misleading, because that that does tend to be what people mean by that.
It's more the idea of spinning in the
– Exactly. But that is actually a different thing, because bias is
everybody filtering – Everybody has bias.
Everything's biased, because bias means filtering – a subset of data through your mechanisms that are used to filter it, right? So in the same sense, like you're just walking around the world and what you see is biased by your ability to identify. Like if you're our druid dad, right, who talked about the past being able to identify any living green thing out in the world, right? If you're a druid and you're walking down the street, right? What you see is not the same thing as like what I see. Right,
because you got that druid bias.
Yeah, you got druid bias, and so like the as you're filtering data in, you're like part of what's happening is you're identifying the trees as you walk by. Right,
you're kind of like, I think it's going to rain today because of the way that this particular bird.
I caught a whiff of something on the wind. That means that there's this tree over here that is about to have tree babies. I don't know.
Whatever. That's a lot of pollen.
It's a lot of pollen. and versus like my experience walking down, which was just like, God, it's hot. I want to get back inside.
It's hot. And I'm sweaty.
Yeah. And that's like, and that's my only experience of the world. Right.
And city boy bias.
Exactly. And that applies to everything, right? It's the way that you see the world is filtered by the context that you've built up. So there's no such thing as bias free, and it's not a thing you need to be avoiding. It's a thing you need to make sure that you are taking into account. That's the important thing, right? So
right, you can't avoid it. Yeah, sorry. The term I should have been using is spin.
Yeah,
which is somebody who is intentionally manipulating the way information is conveyed in order to sway an opinion about something.
Right. But and I think
that's a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem. But it's also a problem if you're not aware of and thinking about bias, because bias isn't inherently bad. It's just how things work, right? Yeah. And if you are thinking about it, then it makes your perception of the world that much better. So if you, and this is true, like, and so this is, and then the reason I'm pushing against this so explicitly and hard is because of the idea that like, oh, it's a report about like this mission to Mars or like the science idea, like the idea of science being unbiased is absolute horseshit in the same sense that any human endeavor is bias. But again, bias meaning filtered through our very limited and very specific understanding of the world, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So just be careful.
I agree.
I agree. That's why I want to make sure we're clear on the ideas.
Yes. Then. That's an important distinction to make. And it's also the case too, that as one kind of one final thought on it, if you do want to know about, especially when it comes to things like what's happening in the political sphere, you just can't avoid spin in those cases.
Yeah, some things are, and so all data is spun in some
context. which is why right now, like, I'm just not subscribed to literally any political news. I was right at first, but it was just a torrent of hot takes and articles which were intentionally pushing a certain narrative, right?
Well, and it's not even necessarily,
and even if it was one I agreed with, but I was like,
but then what value is getting, good for right?
me? Yeah.
Well, and that's part of the whole echo chamber thing too. Is like echo chambers are they're dangerous on the one hand because you're limiting the stuff that you're exposed to, but also even outside of that, they aren't useful because you already believe all the stuff that you're reading. So like, what's the point?
New perspectives?
But I think the main thing to avoid is when it comes to spin, because there's the spin that's intentional because someone's trying to cause something to happen, and there's the one that is caused because people are not interested in the thing itself, but they're interested in the ability of that thing to generate money, right? And so this is, which of course is also what most political spin is, but in the sense of like, if a thing is being given to you for entertainment purposes, which is how social media algorithms work and how YouTube algorithms work and how CNN and I mean any literally any news source, because their goal is actually to sell advertising, right? And they do that by keeping you there and having you click on lots of things. And the way that they do that is by entertaining you, right? So if you're using an entertainment medium to get information, it will be biased towards things that will cause you to spend more time there.
Yeah. And of course, the more outraged you are, the more you're like, oh God, I got to keep an eye on this just in case something terrible is about to happen that I need to react to, you know? So I've been having a great couple of weeks. Been very chill, learning cool things that are happening that I previously wasn't hearing about because they're not outrageous, you know. So I'm having a great time. Highly, highly recommend.
Yeah, I did a similar thing but I finally actually just logged into Reddit on anything I'm using and then subscribed to the things I was interested in and now don't look at the front page or that kind of stuff. So I only look at my subscribe things. So when I look at Reddit now, I see most things about Docker, Vue, Node.js, and spiders, because that's the collection of stuff I'm into. And then also there's less stuff when you're limiting it to the stuff that actually matters to you, right, and impacts you. Then there's also just less shit that you got to dig through.
All right, now we also need to talk about NukeCat.
Yeah. Yes. So we've mentioned my cats various times on the podcast. So I've got a pile of them now at this point. And my old grandma, NukeCat, who I've had for 11 years, so she turned 12 this year, which I was thinking like 11 years is a long time, but it's even longer when I think that means I was 23 when I got her, you know, it's a fucking baby when I got this cat.
Yeah.
So, And I mean baby in relative terms. You know, like if you're 23, I know you don't think you're a baby. And I don't think you're a baby. I'm just saying, like, you know what I'm saying.
But later, you will look back and think that you were a baby.
Every time my wife and I see one of our wedding pictures sitting up on a counter on our first floor. And like every time one of us looks at it, we're like, who let these babies get married? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so I've had this cat for 12 years or 11 years. She's 12. And best fucking cat in the universe. She's great. She's the past few months started just like losing weight really rapidly. Been kind of cranky for a long time. Turns out she's hyperthyroid. And so on Tuesday this week, brought her to a specialty vet who injected her with radioactive iodine. And then she had to stay in the hospital for 2 days. And we got her back, but now she's radioactive to a level we're supposed to be very careful about for the next 2 weeks. So,
and this is the same treatment that you give to humans for
thyroid. It's exactly the same. Yeah, the thyroid treatment is very, very cool. I think we can get into kind of a little science corner here. I won't get into like a lot of detail, but your thyroid it's a thing that sits up in your neck, right? It's a little weird organ that just squirts out disgusting hormones, right? But there are these two thyroid hormones in particular.
Yeah, it's so gross.
Everything biology is fucking gross. But the cool thing about it is that iodine, the element, right, is used by your body almost exclusively in these hormones made by the thyroid, and basically nowhere else. Like it is actually everywhere, and people are like, it's probably used for other stuff, but we don't know what else it's doing because it's classic biology and science, right? So. But what we do know, and what we've known for a long time, is that iodine is used in your thyroid. So thyroid issues are pretty common. They've been common for the whole history of humankind. And a clever person a long time ago, once we discovered radioactivity and we actually found out ways to make radioactive versions of things and so on, right, realized that you can do a whole bunch of cool stuff with the thyroid specifically by fucking around with iodine, right? Because that's just where iodine goes when you put it in someone's body. And so they found that if you make a kind of a less deadly radioactive version of iodine, you can use it for imaging because you inject somebody with it. It goes to the thyroid. Right? And when I say goes to, I mean it sticks there because the blood's just taking it everywhere, right? So it sticks there, shoots out a little bit of radiation, catch it on an X-ray film or whatever, right? And you're like, oh, cool, I can see your thyroid now. So that's neat. And then somebody else, or maybe the same person, who knows, was like, you know, if we get a more deadly one in here, so get some
kill that thyroid.
Get some iodine that is so radioactive that it just murders cells, right? Then it'll preferentially stick there. So that's where the highest concentration will be, which means we can give a person a low concentration, as in like a small amount, that in your whole body basically isn't doing anything. Because yeah, it's radioactive and it's still shooting your cells, but it's like, doesn't really, not a big deal because your cells are getting shot by the sun all the time anyway, right? So no biggie. But then in your thyroid, it all concentrates. Just fucking nukes your cells, right? Mm-hmm. And just kills them all. But then even cooler, in particular, it only kills, depending on how much you put in there, it only kills the ones that are really actively using iodine. Because the more iodine the cells are using, then the more of this radioactive iodine they accumulate, and the more likely they are to die.
If you have a hyperactive thyroid,
exactly,
then this will knock out the cells that are being bad. And if you have cancer,
and nothing else, and if you have cancer, because thyroid cancers tend to be the same mechanism, same things mm-hmm. that are producing lots of it, right? And so it's like an amazing, it's the same idea of like of cancer therapies where you take you basically exploit some property that is specific enough, right, to the cancer that you can put something in that is a global poison. Like putting radioactivity in your body is a global poison, right? But it's you exploit a mechanism that means that almost all the damage occurs in the one place you want.
Yeah, it's actually it's basically the dream of like targeted chemotherapy.
Yeah, this is always the goal of every chemotherapy is like, and I think this is cool. We've been doing this apparently for like 50 years or something. We've been doing radioiodine mm-hmm. therapy in people and I don't know how long in pets, but probably it started there actually because, you know, that's how we find things out. But it's just like, it's just amazing because like you don't feel anything. It's completely harmless. Like you just, and for people, it's even easier because people are autonomous and you can tell them things, right? And they can do stuff intentionally. And then most importantly, like, most of the radioactivity, then it decays. Half-life is like 8 days. So it's decaying slowly anyway, but also you're just excreting a lot of it through your pee and poop, right? But for people, that's fine because you just throw it down the toilet immediately, right? For pets, it's a problem because cats are shitting in a box and dogs are shitting outside, right? And in all cases, there's now like a radioactive pile of poop that has to be dealt with. But yeah, so we got this done and got her back, and it's just kind of, it was very expensive. So that's also kind of a thing. It turns out making radioactive things is costly. But it's very cool, like, that this kind of thing just works, and that the only thing I was worried about the whole time for, like, for the treatment was basically just like she had to be alone for 2 days, like in a cell with a few other cats with like lead lining everywhere, you know, for the initial phase of it. But that was it. I mean, like, there's no other side effects. It's really truly amazing. Right. So but now for the next 2 weeks, I can't keep her on my lap, and I have to be like be careful cleaning out the litter box and stuff, which is
right. So you're being far less worried about the actual downstream side effects of the treatment, and more about just like driving the cat to the vet and like that sort of stuff. Yeah.
So it is very, in terms of like medical interventions, it's a remarkable, very, very cool one. It's one of those, like, everything had to come together just right, right? Like, we had to learn about iodine as an element, as a thing, right? Figure out what it did in the body, discover that it only did basically one thing, then learn about hyperthyroidism and like understand that that was a thing that was caused by the thyroid in the first place. And then like, think about all the dots had to be connected here where someone was like, hey, if we just make a nuclear, make radioactive iodine and just put it in you. We just put it in there, right? We can just fix this. No problem, right? It's just really one of those, I think it's one of those very, very cool kinds of places where honestly we lucked out in as humanity did, at the intersection of like the reality of how biology works and the reality of how physics works and our ability to understand all of those things. And then people at the moments in history, like, coming together and realizing the implications of all of this, like, this kind of a neat little puzzle piece fit is so fucking rare.
Yes, it's a this far is why, cleaner interaction than just about anything else.
Right? Yeah, yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, this is why you got to have 7 billion people.
Exactly.
So that you increase the chances that one of them learns the right combination of things at the right time.
Yeah.
To make a big difference.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things about the cost of science too, right? Is like, as people get obsessed with looking at science reports or looking at where the funding is going and being like, oh, was it worth it for us to like spend this money doing this? We didn't even learn anything, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, yeah, with the cost of us learning the cool things that are really impactful, because you can't do that on purpose. That's not how anything works. You stumble across it as a feature of like having everybody and all the information in the right place at the right time. The only way to do that is by spending fucking enormous amounts of money doing things that don't pan out, right? It's just like
they don't pan out yet.
Yes, or in the way you expect or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. Because as long as everything you do generates some nugget of knowledge, even if it's like, you know, we're 60% confident that this thing that we thought worked doesn't work. Yep. You know, that's still something.
It's weird to me. There's a chance that can be useful for something.
It's so odd to me that the framing around like the science community in particular has that sort of almost that perfectionist quality to it, where it's like, well, if you're not getting exact results out of it, then like we don't want to fund this. Because if you think about a person, like, again, you as a personal entity and how learning works and everything like that, if you took that approach to any fucking thing that you wanted to do, if you were like, all right, I'm going to spend some time, doing some drawing because I want to get good at drawing. Mm-hmm. You do your first drawing some cubes. That's garbage. You can't do anything with that. You're not going to sell that. No one's going to care about this. You know, like it's an insane. All right,
we're going to pull premise. Your funding now. You can't draw anymore.
Yeah. Like what? Like if you treat a person like that, it's just, you would get nowhere, you know, in no time at all.
This is also, why we need universal basic income, you know, because
there you go.
You got to have the space to roll dice and just try shit that may or may not pan out, because that's where all the awesome stuff comes from. And most of it doesn't pan out. But if that were fine, then we'd end up with more awesome stuff.
If you've got a safety net, then you can roll more dice.
Yep.
So very interesting stuff. I always enjoy the science corner. It's a good time. All right, let's talk about some studio news. We've been working on Crashlands 2 a lot. It is a lot. As we've discussed in the past, we are pushing sort of every aspect of our skills and knowledge about making games to try a bunch of new stuff in Crashlands 2. Will it all work? Will it all pan out? No. But
some of it, we certainly hope so.
Maybe.
But I mean, speaking of safety nets, the reason that we can make Crashlands 2 and spend this time trying to make it as amazing as possible is because of the prior successes of our last titles, right?
Right.
If we didn't have the time, we wouldn't have the time, and we would just have to keep doing what we've been doing in the past.
We'd have to make Crashlands 2, but it would be very much like original Crashlands.
Yep.
Just sort of through and through, because we've already answered all the all those questions, right? So a couple things that we're working on is answering some questions about multiplayer. Can we do it? What will it take? And we're also answering some questions about the world and how to build this world. So we want to kind of spend a few minutes talking about each of these things, because I think it's kind of interesting just to kind of get a glimpse into what we're thinking.
And as always, no promises. We're in the exploratory phase of Crashlands 2. We don't know if it's going to be multiplayer. We don't know if it's going to have art. We don't know.
We don't know anything.
We don't know anything. Don't know.
It might be tech. It might be a text-based
MUD.
You know, MMO. It could be paper. It could be a board game. We don't know.
Yep.
So as far as multiplayer stuff goes, we'll talk a little bit about the door problems associated with multiplayer, namely stuff that sounds pretty straightforward on its face, and that most people would think like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, I get this concept, right? But as with many things, once you actually start to really think about what it means, it suddenly everything gets flipped on its head.
And this is what we see, because you'll see comments, and this still happens even to this day, especially because of how the various game engines have allowed you know, a lot of us who didn't necessarily come with like engine based knowledge or necessarily networking based knowledge to create both games and multiplayer games. Then there appears to be this seeming thought in the gamer community that adding multiplayer is somehow easy.
It's just not a big deal somehow.
You'll see every so often, if you ever look at comments on YouTube videos like that, you know, you might see someone say something along these lines, which is like, why isn't there multiplayer? I don't get it. Like, it's a thing that everybody does. It's easy.
And what we've always said, we've always said, like, if you want multiplayer, you have to understand that the timeline and the cost to actually make the game should just be assumed to be doubled, right? Mm-hmm. And we just kind of picked that out of a hat because, like, we've never done it. But we know that it's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
So as we've dug into it, especially in this past week and a half here, where Adam has been doing some prototyping and poking around, it's one of those things where when you describe what needs to happen, the description of what needs to happen is rather simple.
Until you actually like start to even dig into that description.
Right? But as we've talked about on the podcast before, simple is not equivalent to easy. And in fact, oftentimes, really what you're saying when you're saying something is simple is you're saying that it's very easy for a human mind to understand. But it is not necessarily easy for any fucking thing else to understand.
And we should say that it is actually very easy today with like the tech that's available and the abstraction layers that are available to you to make a really bad multiplayer experience. It's very easy to do that.
To just like establish connections between computers and then start like, sending packets.
Yeah, just like fire hose, like here's my XY coordinates. Now you can see me, right? You can see me walking around on your screen and I can see you walking around on my screen, right? It's very, very easy to set up a non-scalable, very bad multiplayer experience. Yep. And that is if you go through any tutorial, like you'll go through an engine tutorial about like here, make a simple multiplayer game, right? That's what you're doing. You're gonna be making a peer-to-peer game, and as in like there's no server in the middle. It's just two games talking to each other, right? And you're just gonna be like fire hosing data back and forth and not really worrying about any details of the implications on the design of the experience of how players get into the game together, where the data is stored, et cetera, right?
It's really once you get into all those fine details that the massive amount of complexity underneath that, what appears to be like a simple surface of getting people connected at first, becomes the thing, the labyrinth that you are now trapped in.
So I think what we should do for this topic is, because we're going to be exploring this for weeks to come, like as we're experimenting with things. And so instead of like trying to hit like, here's everything that we're currently like is on our minds about multiplayer, we should probably just like pick a thing that is a current interesting problem and just kind of like dig into that a little bit. Because as Sam noted, like there's already a list now that we've already mentioned of like things that it's like, oh yeah, how do you connect to people? And like that sound like they're simple, but each one of those is like 10 hours of a discussion we could possibly have.
Yeah. So let's just do then the like player joining a game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Player generated game. Okay, so what has to happen? So now first thing you have to do is answer the first question is, do the players come into the game at the same time, which is a lobby.
A lobby.
So a lobby means everybody meets somewhere. They meet in a thing that isn't the game. And then they all start the game at the same time.
So if you play Fortnite, if you played Among Us, basically any multiplayer, oftentimes competitive.
Left 4 Dead 2.
Game, you always start in a lobby scenario. And there's a big reason for this.
Yeah, the question is why, right? And the reason is because that's the easiest way for you to guarantee that everybody knows has the same information about the game, right? Because you get everybody together. You know exactly what they know about the game, which is nothing because the game hasn't started yet. And then the server or one of the players or whatever creates the game. They create all the data. They create everything else, right? And they send that to all the other players in one big batch. Get everybody to agree, I've got that. I've got that huge bolus of data, right? Like, we know what the current state is and we're ready to go. Everyone's synced up and then you start blasting data back and forth, right?
That's probably also going to be the simplest state that you're going to start with, right?
Yeah.
Because there's nothing has happened.
No changes.
Yet. No changes. Yeah. So in other words,
And so now, this is now also assuming that you're not, it's not just that you're starting from a lobby, but you're going from a lobby into a fresh game, right? Because the alternative to that is, what if you can say, so you'll notice that most of the, many of the games that you play multiplayer, like Left 4 Dead, a lot of first-person shooters, right? When you play in a session, like with other players, you're just starting over. You're just starting the game over, right?
There's no persistence.
There's no persistence. So if there's no persistence, very easy, because the game itself knows everything it needs to know about what the game is, because that's just in the game code, right? Okay, so you can have a lobby. And then you can choose, like, okay, do I have persistent data that I have to, like, get? So now if you have persistent data, where do you get it? Is it only stored on one player's machine? How do I convert that into a format that I can send over the network?
So let's say two of us have been playing for 40 minutes or so, and then the third one hops in.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Now you get around the question of, like, what if people can come midstream? So it's not just in a lobby, right?
So how the hell do they catch up to everything?
How do they catch up? Right. So now that means you need to be able to take, so everybody else, you may have been sending, like, here's what's changed. Like, people are just keeping track of changes over time. Now all of a sudden someone needs all the data, or not even all of it. They need enough data to represent the current set of everything that matters, right? And they also need to get that, but everything has to happen over time, right? So by the time they get that information, things have changed again, right? So then also have to keep track of what's changed since you packaged up all that data together. And now if you're trying to do that in a way that doesn't interrupt gameplay for all the other players, then you have to do that asynchronously, meaning you're packaging up data while the data is changing. So how the fuck do you even know what has changed? Like, what has actually changed, right, since the last time
you said? And there's an indeterminable amount of lag. So
everything's happening in the past.
Yeah, so somebody joins. Maybe they have 8-millisecond ping. Boom, no problem. There's very little stuff happening between the time that they got the game state and finally, like, load into the game, right? But what if somebody's on a 500 ms ping? What if they're on a half-second delay?
What if they're dropping half of all of the data that you send?
Yeah.
Right.
What if they have a terrible connection and they're dropping packets? Then you got to resend a bunch of it. You know, you got to verify all of it, which means it takes even longer to send it, which means even more things.
Well, just the other thing too, when it comes back to this idea of this being easy, because people can say, oh, it's easy because, like, I can prototype this in like 10 minutes on my, you know, in Unity or GameMaker or whatever. But you're doing that on your own computer, right?
With
zero ping and zero data loss. So what you're seeing is, like, you can just, like, blast data. It's gonna be perfectly in sync. There's no lag. You can design the whole game around that experience. But the moment that you're now talking to somebody else on a different machine, and there's delay and there's loss of data, then the experience that you saw is like, now you just have to solve that suddenly.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. And there's no way to do it. Because that's a good part of this too, is like, there's no just way to do multiplayer. That's not a thing, right? It depends. In the same way, there's no way to make a game. Yeah. There are good decisions that people have made. There's stuff that's worked out pretty well. There are a handful of overarching strategies and ways of thinking about the problem. And that work more or less successfully depending on the game. But for any given game, you can't just, like, go off the shelf and be like, oh, I took this thing and I plugged in multiplayer and I got it, right? Because it depends completely on the kind of data that you're dealing with. And so if you take something now like Crashlands, so you think of even the old Crashlands, got an inventory, you got pets, you got characters running around the world, you got NPCs, you got progress through quests. You got loot drops that that happen as a consequence of you destroying a thing, right? Each one of those kinds of things has to be data that's being shipped back and forth across a network to other players in a way that makes it so that all players are seeing basically the same thing, right? There's no other game that does things exactly like we do. So what so are we gonna,
there's no article we can read that's just like, here's how you would add multiplayer to Crash.
Yeah, even if there was a game. Like, so even if it took like, take like Don't Starve Together, right? Which is probably gonna be the closest analog to what we need to pull off for multiplayer. Still not the same, but it's the closest analog. That shit isn't public. We don't know how they did it, right? So it doesn't even matter.
Not only that, but that the design challenges that we have is like, it largely comes down to the quests, the questing system, right? Because like quests change the state of the world.
Yeah.
And so if you join a game and somebody has done a quest that say like gives them a particular item, right? Now there's one of that item. But what if you need that item to advance to a next quest, but that person has disconnected?
Yep.
Who has it?
Where did it go?
Is it just gone now? What if they never come back?
So as you can see, it's so easy. Like, we're already getting into the other details, right? Just by asking the question. Because
they're all tangled together.
And you can't just answer one question without getting into the others. So basically, I've been like prototyping really basic models of like a client server that are talking to try to model some of these things just to get some of these basic questions. Like, what does it mean to create and join a session? What does that mean? Like, to create a game and start playing it. And then most importantly, what does it mean to start sending data? What does that mean? Like, what, starting with the simplest thing possible of like having the character move around, right? Mm-hmm. How does that work?
All game systems always start with moving the player.
They do. I said this talk about in the past too, right? It's like one of the earliest problem that you face if you make a 2D game is how does the player stand on the ground? Right.
If it's like a platformer.
And I know from, I've only made one jam game by myself, where I like did significant game programming.
And coming into it, you're like, player standing on the ground. This is a solved problem.
Yeah. I spent almost the entire time trying to get the player to properly be on the ground. Like that was the entirety of me, like of my weekend, trying to figure out how the fuck to solve that. The problem that I had never even thought of as a problem, right? It was just like, players stand on things. Like, that's an op. Like,
probably after that, you let them fall, and then they started teleporting through the ground. You're like,
Damn it! Exactly. Yeah. Because if it can stand on things, that means it can also fall through things or jump or whatever. But that whole question of like, what does it mean to stand on something, right? Is a kind of question that you don't realize you need to ask. And the same thing with multiplayer. It's like, what does it mean to join a game? What is a game? What is joining? Like, these things that seem obvious, right? Just like, join a game. You're just in there now, right?
What is data?
Right? Yeah. Like the whole thing, it turns into a clusterfuck. So
fast. Honestly, though, I love this shit. Like, this is,
it's a blast.
This is what kind of hooked me into programming games to begin with, because that first couple weeks, I was like, I'm going to make a platformer. I'm going to do it. And it was literally 2 weeks of several hours a day reading stuff and like trying things and trying to get this character to not fall through the ground. And it was one of those interesting things where I knew what the outcome was going to be, because I've played so many games where the character doesn't fall through the ground.
Well, you knew what it was supposed to be like as an experience, right?
But you didn't know
how to describe the problem in a way that made sense for a computer to describe the problem.
Yeah. And it was so fascinating for me to try to like uncover it, because what you end up with is, and you'll see this too if you go to say like the Game Maker forums or the Game Maker subreddit or like any community where people are programming games, is you get a lot of these new developers in, and the way that they phrase problems is like, how do I have a gun shoot bullets?
Right.
And it's like, well, that's a deep question, right? Because like, what's a gun and what's a bullet and what is shooting? Because every game is going to have a different interpretation of that. And what you have to understand is like how to create instructions. for the computer to do the thing, the concept.
Yeah, and the first part is being able to even understand what the question is. Because like with the whole idea of like, how do I make a gun shoot bullets, right? Because then you say like, okay, do I need a bullet? Is that actually required? Because, or do I just need damage? Because, and then like, and what's pointing? How do I know if I'm pointing at a thing, right? So like, is it sufficient to just point at a thing and like, and then capture an input? And then the question is, what are my inputs and how do I get them, right? But yep, capture an input and then like see if that thing was pointing at something, which then the question is, how do you know that? How do you see where it's pointing and then see if that is at a certain thing?
Yep.
Right? Which requires knowing where both of those things are, and et cetera, right? And then once I do that, like,
it's not trivial.
It's not trivial. It's like, how much damage did I do? You know?
Like, yeah.
What's damage? How does that work?
How much health does it have? How do you know both of those things?
Yep.
Does it have armor? Does damage get mitigated?
The long and short of it is.
And now let's put this over a fucking network and try to figure out how to get it to people.
Yeah. The long and short of it is, if you ever see someone who says something like, you know, I don't get why they haven't put multiplayer in this, I've done it in a prototype, like in a weekend, you just know that that person is very, very early on in that Dunning-Kruger effect. That's yes, just about all you
need. Well, here's what I love about that phrasing, though. When they're like, I don't understand why this isn't in the game. The proper response is like, yeah, you don't.
Yeah,
right. Right? Like,
yeah, correct.
Yeah, no, you're that's true. It? You're right that you don't you're understand
well, this is true of anything. Anything in game design hits the same set of problems, right? Because like, as we described, like the shooting a thing, right? That's, it's obvious to you as a person who plays games or just as an experience, right? Like, yeah, I want to shoot. I want to be holding a gun. I want to pull a trigger and I want to have this thing take damage. Like, it's obvious to you what that means. But the moment you go to unpack that, to do it, to implement it, it turns into spaghetti, right? It turns into a nightmare. And this is true for anything. So when people are asking us questions about like, ooh, why can't we just have this in level head? What if you just added this? What if we changed this to do this other thing or whatever, right? Even when those things are easy to do, it's not obvious how they should be done, and the consequences are potentially very, very far-reaching, right? And so, yeah, it's just one of those. I think with games in particular, there's the difference between your experience of the thing and what's required to make that experience happen, and the options available to you to make that experience happen.
So divergent,
so huge.
But I think there's a really important note here too on, like, for anybody who is making their own game or anything like that, which is the thrill you get from finally solving one of these problems is just not equivalent to the thrill someone else will get from interacting with it. So, for example,
that was true.
You figuring out also how to stand on the ground will feel, the first time you do it, will feel like you just fucking climbed Mount Everest. Like,
it's
just
a monumental achievement.
You're like, where's my Nobel Peace Prize?
Yeah. Ready. And you will tell everyone about it, and you will want to share your game. And you will share the game, and people will be like, cool, they won't even notice. People won't even notice what you did.
It's just assumed you can stand on the ground.
And this is, because, and why couldn't you? Yeah, this is a big problem, because like, you get into this state, and this is something we always are watching out for when you come to thinking about features and thinking about what you're going to be developing. Because there are features that you will develop that, because they are hard to develop, you will inflate their importance to the player at the end of the day on the design side. You'll be like, we're finally done with X thing, and like, all players gonna love it, and people will not even fucking notice. And so you have to be very, very keen on like, where your dev time is going, and making sure that you're not necessarily, it's like engine making at that point, right? Which is you're making it because it's enjoyable to make and solve the problems, and you have to still make sure at the end of the day that you can very directly connect the output of this thing to an experience that the player is gonna have, where ideally they are able to have an experience that is as big as your experience building the thing. And sometimes you have these that are groundwork, that are essentially these, you know, basic science things. Like, you have to be able to stand on the ground to do literally fucking anything in like a side-scrolling game, right? You have to use that as the setup for whatever your actual mechanical thing is. But no one's going to care about you standing on the ground.
No, because that's just – it's assumed – like, it's such an obvious thing that should happen that your users don't experience that as like a – problem.
It's not a feature. It's not a feature of the game.
Yeah, it's the same thing with the multiplayer experience, right? Which is, if it has multiplayer and I hit join game, I should just be in it, and I'm not going to notice a damn thing about that.
No, right? No matter how slick the implementation is. And the fact is that implementation in any multiplayer game you've ever played, no matter how simple and basic it was, like, if it worked in production, like if it worked and you're playing with people in other states or countries or whatever, right? If that worked, and the vast majority of the time you're able to complete a full game without like something really bad happening, things getting desynced, whatever, right? If you're able to do that, you just played a remarkable piece of very clever technology, right? You really did. Even the ones that are just like barely scrapped together that work most of the time, there's just so much going on there that is so complicated. And the fact that we don't even this is true. Like as you dig into game development and actually start realizing what all the questions are and how like non-obvious it is to implement things and things as simple as standing on the floor, right? Then every time you play a game after that, you're always just like, how the fuck? And every time I play, because we don't do 3D, right? So I don't know anything about like how 3D stuff is done. And like every time I play a 3D game, now that I know how hard it is to stand on the floor in a 2D game, right? And you go into a 3D game where the floor is now this three-dimensional surface.
It's a mesh.
It's a mesh. Yeah. It's a mesh, but it actually doesn't, like, you think of it like you're sitting on the ground, right? But you're not, because that it's a 2D, it's not a 2D plane. It's a bunch of little tiny 2D objects stuck together, right? But it has no width or height, I guess, since you're on the ground, right? And there's no depth to that. Mm-hmm. It's not even paper thin or whatever. Like, it doesn't have a thickness, right? It's just an imaginary, rumbly thing that you're walking on, right?
It's just a bunch of triangles.
It's just a bunch of triangles.
Of different orientations. Of
different orientation. Yeah, with no depth. So how the fuck does the... And then what is a character, right? Because you're looking at as if you're inhabiting a character, but what is a character? Because actually it's just a camera, right? That's moving around. Mm-hmm. But then what's a camera? Well, anyway, it starts getting really wonky.
I saw a screenshot. It's crazy. I saw a screenshot the other day of like it was a game, characters running along, and they stopped running. And one of their feet was propped up on a pebble.
Oh my god, that's amazing!
I was like, oh my god! Yeah. And the thing is, I know the concepts of like how that is done, but I only know of the concepts.
Right.
If I was gonna go do that, it would probably take me a month. Yep. You know?
It's something dumb. It's like have the player be able to have their foot on a pebble, right? It's just like...
Right. Instead of their foot going through the pebble, which was the old, method, right? You just like stand in your normal standing pose and whatever clips through your feet just clips through your feet, and that's that.
And then you just make your stuff small so that you don't have to worry about it, right? Even playing a game, like I was playing Control, which is like the most recent AAA title I played was Control like a year ago at this point. But the way that you interact with terrain, where you like depending on how you run and you jump, like the character just kind of automatically like grabs and pulls herself up and stuff. Mm-hmm. And this way that just feels so good. But the whole time that I'm doing, I'm like, how could you possibly make a system that like works this well? Right.
Yeah. And that is optimized.
That is optimized. Yeah. Cause also in that game too, like everything is destructible. Right. So like you can go up to a bookcase, but there'll be like a whole row of bookcases and you can shoot every single book off of it. Right. And you can like shoot each board that makes up the thing. And then it'll slowly collapse and break into more and more pieces. And I'm just like,
but how the,
I can imagine the huge list of problems that have to be solved to make this seemingly simple. And but there's a reason that like, Control was really the first one with this kind of like particular destructible terrain, right? Because once you've seen it, you're like, oh yeah, I should just be able to shoot things.
And this is the problem, right? Because you take now this thing, which is a unbelievable achievement in terms of like figuring out how to get a computer to do this. And now it becomes a thing that if your game doesn't have it going forward,
then you say,
like, oh, there's not a destructible terrain in there? Like, what the fuck is this? Yeah.
So what are they even doing?
Yeah.
Why don't they just add destructible terrain in physics?
It's all very hard.
I love it. It's amazing, but it's very hard. All right, let's get on to, a question. Ready?
Ready. Yep.
All right, this question comes from our highest upvoted user over at podcast.bscotch.net. Woland77 asks, does the explosive post-end of support popularity of Among Us have any meaningful lessons for developers about maintaining their old games, or is it just a statistical outlier with no real lessons for anyone?
I think it's somewhere in between. And actually, we already learned this lesson with Crashlands because last summer we got a publishing deal with. Was the name of the company with Playon. Playon. Bending Spoons is the company name.
Yeah.
Who wanted Crashlands for the new service that they were using. And because we'd been maintaining Crashlands, it was a fairly simple technical affair to provide that to them technically so that we could focus on the business question of like, is this viable, et cetera, right? And the business deal that we made with them is one that allowed us to publish Level Head in the state we published it in. Because if we hadn't made that deal, we'd have had to publish Level Head a lot earlier to stay afloat. So we already learned that lesson with Crashlands, because Crashlands at that point was a 4-year-old game, right? And it still had the opportunity to significantly impact our business. So we learned that there. And then watching Among Us, where similar kind of a deal, only a little more extreme, actually a lot more extreme, right? Where they had a game that they felt like was dead, and they'd given up support. We're planning on making version 2. And then suddenly the thing explodes with like a degree of popularity that is unachievable absurd. And absurd, you know, in the vast, vast, vast majority of circumstances, to the point where
Among Us was surpassing Fortnite on Twitch. For
it was surpassing
while.
Everything. Like, it was surpassing absolutely everything. And then, you know, and then AOC is playing it with some of the top streamers.
She gets like 500,000 viewers.
Yeah. Prior to a US presidential election and like all this kind of shit. Right. So that gulf there is really dramatic and very impressive, and that should not be the takeaway, because that is not
– because that is the statistical outlier part.
Yeah. But conceptually, that idea we've actually bought into fully because of Crashlands, where we found that the reason that we're still here as a studio is because of Crashlands and because of not exactly random, but sometimes random and surprising opportunities that have come up that – because we kept the game alive even deep in the tail and kept it up to date, kept it running on all of its devices and so on, we were able to act quickly on business opportunities that came up. And this is why we migrated the whole portfolio over the past few months to use Rumpus and to get them all up to date on this version of Game Maker and to do all of this stuff, so that it adds a constant overhead to keep all these things alive and running. But the constant overhead is then low relative to our normal workflow, right? And then at any given moment, if something happens, right, we're ready for it. And so,
yeah. This is just like we're talking about with scientific breakthroughs. This is why you need 7 billion humans, because then the chance of one of them achieving something big goes up, right? So you just need 7 billion games that you're maintaining, and the probability of one of them taking off you know, you've got a higher chance.
Well, and you can think about things too. It's like, it's because you could fairly ask, well, what about like Quadrupus Rampage and Towel Fight 2, right? Like, those are not likely. It is very, very unlikely that someone's going to reach out to us and be like, I'm going to give you $1 billion to like have this game, or that they're going to blow up in popularity and make us a bunch of money, especially because they're monetized super poorly, right? But it is possible that somebody will stumble across Quadrupus Rampage, and then they happen to be a publisher and like, oh, this game is cool. I want to see what else these people are making. And then they see that we're making Crashlands 2, and they're like, ooh, I want in on this, right? Or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know what kind of opportunities are going to become available to you. And so if it's reasonably cost effective to keep all the balls in the air, right? To keep rolling all these dice, then I think it's a good strategy if you can afford it. And there's always this question when it comes to like things you can afford of the converse, which is, can you afford not to, right? Which is just, there's no answer, because it depends on the unpredictable outcomes. Because looking back, you can always easily say, oh, it was or was not worth it. But you can't do that looking forward, right? So there's just no way to know. And so for us, the strategy is basically to say, let's do what we can to keep the costs extremely low for us to maintain our portfolio, so that if an opportunity arises, we can capitalize on it immediately at minimum cost.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, you just never know. You never know what's coming, and you want to keep your opportunities open, right?
Yep. Yep.
That's that. All right. Let's try to do one quick question, because I don't want to just do a single question. I feel like that's, you know,
cheating.
It's just too few. all right. Fly Happy Axe Rampa says, in my life, I try to make my own decisions. I find that leaders and mentors are just as flawed as anyone else. However, you guys are my weakness. Sam is switching to Clip Studio Paint. I'm switching. If you guys switch to Unity or Unreal, I would switch. The whole reason I started learning web dev stuff is because Adam is on your team. Are there any tools you use, or really anything you do, that you believe listeners shouldn't try to emulate? Okay, so I just want to say, we do the things we do because of the specific context that we're in.
Yeah.
So one example here is we use Game Maker Studio because we believe that it is the best thing for 2D.
But also, right? Why are we doing 2D?
Why are we doing 2D? Because we started in 2D and we built up all of our tools, and it's cheap for us to continue to operate.
Yeah, we believe it's the most cost effective for us to stay, and actually then the least risky as a consequence to stay in 2D.
Yeah, if we were to be starting a fresh studio now with no tools and no previous IP and no maintenance on an existing portfolio, would we be using GameMaker and would we be making 2D games? I don't know.
Yeah, hard to say. The games we would make.
Yeah,
and also because our 2D games are far easier to make than 3D games, so the cost of development stays a lot lower. And so if you're moving into the indie space, right, where it's all risk and almost no reward most of the time, right, then being able to get stuff out faster with less educational overhead, meaning you get to learn less and still produce more, right, is a huge advantage to you. But at the cost of making 2D games, which potentially have a smaller market.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting point here, which is that if you can find people who freely talk about how they do things and what they're doing, why, and that happens to line up both in terms of values, interests, and your own current context, then it is a win.
You get to take advantage of them making the mistakes for you.
Yeah, it is a massive win to have that in your back pocket. I think the big thing to watch out for is just to make sure that your context is actually the same.
Sufficiently
matched up. So me switching to Eclipse Studio Paint has come after now basically 2 years of taking some art classes in the evenings and weekends.
And 7 years of using Inkscape.
And 7 years of using Inkscape, experiencing what that means and what that has meant for us in terms of art production, putting out a couple of games, and just thinking that, you know, maybe part of the issue is as far as where I would like to go with the art is that I'm only working in vector. So the reason to switch to Eclipse Studio Paint is to be able to do both vector and painter.
Well, and then we're moving for like I can do with Levelhead and also for Crashlands too. We're moving into a less programmatically animated and like programmatically like visual experience. Yeah,
it's far less of me throwing random body parts at Seth and being like, I don't know, put it together somehow, and more so me being like, here it is, completely.
Here's a full animation.
And so Clip Studio Paint was a good choice because it's an animation platform, right?
It's got an animation tool inside of it. So it's one of those things where I think as long as you still ask the question of if the context makes sense for you, then yeah, it's a big win. And this is why I think finding, like, if you finally find a YouTuber or find a podcast, or frankly, any source of basically essentially asynchronous mentorship, if the context fits, then it is definitely a win. There will be a time where it runs out. And this is what I always think is so interesting, because like no two growth paths are the same, right? Mm-hmm. And so while we may continue honing these 2D skills, and actually go deeper and deeper into that, there also may be a time where we actually split, because some of the 2D skills that I'm getting on the art side now are exactly the things that I would need for doing really effective 3D work as well, versus before they weren't quite as easily mapped. And so what that means is that there might be a point in the future where we say, actually, we're going to go do 3D now, which means we're going to ditch this engine. We're going to do all this other stuff. But you might have a different context and say, well, I'm going to keep doing this, you know, on my side. And so I think as long as you're routinely asking the question, does this fit, then you're fine.
Just remember, it's one of our studio principles: always know why.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you know why, then you're good to go. Just make sure you know. So I think that's it. It's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers Fat Bard and Jen Coster for putting the podcast together, and thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to everything you could ever want out of life. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.